I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Man is the measure of all things, so wrote the Greek philosopher Protagoras in the middle of the 5th century BC. It's easy to assert that man is the measure of all things, but measuring mankind and womankind's achievements, statistically ranking which human being made the greatest contribution to our shared history, is an altogether more difficult task. Objective standards of why one artist or scientist is more important than another seem hard to define as shifting views of what is beautiful and new discoveries about the macro and micro structures of the universe open new areas of scientific inquiry. Undaunted by this problem, sociologist Charles Murray, no stranger to controversy, has decided to have a go anyway. Using statistical models, he has put together a series of best-of-the-best lists in his new book, Human Accomplishment, and the analysis raises some provocative questions. Connection listeners, is it possible to rate human accomplishment across the centuries, across cultures? Do you buy Murray's claim that the West bests the East in science and the arts? And when it comes to intellectual achievement, who do you think is the greatest of all time? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. And my guest this hour is Charles Murray, the W.H. Brady Scholar in Culture and Freedom at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Hello, Charles.
Good morning, Michael.
Now, just to be clear, you're actually in Dallas.
I'm in Dallas today,
okay.
Yes.
We just want to know what part of the country you're answering questions from today. Now, this book, it's an interesting book. What made you want to write it?
You may remember Daniel Boorstin's book back in the early 80s, The Discoverers, won a Pulitzer Prize.
Mm-hmm.
I read that, and I loved it. But it was also a kind of connected series of biographies. And what I really wanted to do was have some way to look at this pageant of human accomplishment whole, you know, look at it across centuries, look at it across countries. And about 6 years ago, that idea, which I'd had sitting in my brain for many years, finally grabbed hold of me, and I went ahead and did it.
But when you say you wanted to look across it, you wanted to look across in a very specific way. You weren't intending to write narrative cultural history. You were looking to kind of quantify achievement to make a case.
I wanted to quantify achievement to see what would come out of it. You know, the question, why Athens? Why Florence? The question of why it is that in some places and sometimes human beings have just done great things, and they've done it in bursts. It hasn't been evenly spread across history and evenly spread across places. So, yes, I did want to explore that, and since I am a quantitative social scientist, one of the first questions that I had was, well, is there any way to do that? And the answer is that there has been, for about 150 years now, a set of techniques that historians and psychologists have been using, which has been quite well developed.
Well, we don't do pie charts on radio, but
yes.
But if you could possibly just summarize for us the statistical methods you were using to compile your lists.
At essence, it's very simple. You take major sources, the most authoritative histories and chronologies and biographical dictionaries and the rest of them, and you measure the amount of attention given to different people. Any one source is not going to be trustworthy in terms of that as the measure. You know, maybe the guy gave Debussy more attention than he gave Chopin for reasons having nothing to do with their importance. But if you take a lot of those sources, those kinds of variations come out in the wash, and you end up what in statistical jargon are exceedingly reliable indexes of the eminence of these people. And in a way, Michael, there's no arguing about whether they are the most eminent because that, in a sense, you're defining as saying the people who get the most attention are the most eminent. The more difficult question, much more difficult, as you indicated in the opening, is does that also reflect real differences in excellence in their work?
And does it?
I would argue yes. Not perfectly. And in fact, a lot of the book, I will point to the reader ways in which the measure of excellence in this field is conflated with something else. But here's the basic premise. If you are a guy who or woman who's been told by Cambridge University Press that they would like you to write a history of music, what you are trying to do is take a life scholarship, because you're a major scholar in this area, and you're trying to tell the reader what they ought to know about the history of music. And when you do that, you don't say, I'm going to give Debussy so many column inches, but you do take time to to talk about those people are the most important. And so in that sense, you've given all that attention to them, not for any arbitrary reason, but because there are deeply important things to say about them because of their work. So, yeah, I would say that there is a relationship to excellence.
Okay. So
not perfect.
Now, your main conclusions after working through the book, you begin by compiling lists that are separated by cultures. I mean, you right. have arts and sciences, but you seem to say that scientific achievement kind of cuts across all cultures because people are using the technologies and so on that develop from scientific discovery. So I'm going to focus, here on artistic achievement. You start by separating them so that you have lists of European authors and Indian authors,
Chinese
and Japanese.
And separate lists, yeah.
And what did you learn by separating them out?
Well, you can't compare apples and oranges in the sense of saying Basho is a lesser or greater writer than Shakespeare, because you simply don't have anybody who is writing on literature who is capable of writing about all that with judgment on these different traditions. Just can't be done. So you're trying to force the data to do things that they aren't intended to do if you combine lists across traditions, I think.
Mm-hmm. But then you summarize everything, and you do, in a sense, conflate those lists.
Oh, there is a chapter, I think the chapter you're referring to is chapter 11, and that's when I'm setting off on the series of chapters that try to explore the question of why Florence, why Athens, or why Sung China, for example. And I start out and I say to the reader, look, in the rest of the chapters of this book, in the analysis of where the great eruptions of human accomplishment occurred, I'm going to keep coming back again and again to one particular place and era. I'm going to be coming back to Europe from about 1400 to 1950. And why do I keep doing that? Because if you want to analyze human accomplishment in terms of the bulk of it, that's where it's concentrated. So in the rest of chapter 11, I go through that exercise, first for the sciences and then for the arts. In the sciences, you can be much more specific. You can really get, I think, fairly precise statements about the firsts, the discoveries, the inventions, and so forth. This is where they happened across the world. With the arts, I make a much broader statement than that, and it goes like this. If you're talking about where the best occurred, then the best occurred all over the world. Du Fu, the Chinese poet, is said by those who are in a position to make such judgments that he was very well, the greatest poet in history, along with Li Bo, I mean, not just in China. So bests occurred everywhere. If you are talking simply about the fine work that has been done and the bulk of it there you've got to say...
So you're talking about...
In terms of bulk, it's coming out of Western Europe.
You're talking about quantity more than quality.
That's right in that statement. In fact, there's an explicit difference, as I just said. However, here's another point to make. If you talk... Let's talk about, let's say, Western art versus Japanese art. Again, you don't say the best of Western is better than or worse than the best of Japanese. If you say, look... Scholars of Japanese art, in writing their most comprehensive histories, are basically talking about X number of people that are kind of the core of the Chinese oeuvre. And if you go over to the West, you've got Y number of people. And there are big differences in those two numbers. Does that mean much in terms, should you make too much of it? No. Is there a difference in the magnitude of fine work that's been done in two traditions? Yeah, there is.
Connection listeners, we're talking this hour with Charles Murray, a man who some of you may know from his previous book, The Bell Curve, Intelligence and Class Structure in American Life. His new book, which is called Human Accomplishment, seeks to quantify the great achievements in the arts and sciences from 800 to 1950 and asks and comes up with the conclusion that the predominance of them have been from Western Europe, most of them by men. And I'm wondering if that's something that you would agree with listeners at face value, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. David is on the line from Floyd, Virginia.
Yes, thank you, sir. And I do agree that Western Europe has been responsible for the rise of what we now see as civilization. And I would like to ask the author if he factored in Christianity as the prevalent religion of that region during the time in question as another factor that led to the freeing of the minds which allowed these technological advancements?
That's a good question,
yes.
David.
This is where I came out in a place I did not expect to. When I went into this work, it was my view that the Greeks laid the foundation in the West. By the time I came out of it, it seemed to me that Catholicism, as reformulated by Aquinas specifically, played a role that certainly I had not given full credit to earlier, even though other historians have, and that it was crucial, a crucial element in the surge that began with the Renaissance. More broadly, I came away at the end of the book, and Michael, I guess I do want to get in something for the readers here. The lists are fun. The comparisons of Europe versus non-Europe are fun. They're good for parlor games. That's not the focus of the book. The focus of the book at the end says, it is fascinating the degree to which the times and places where humans have achieved the greatest in the arts and sciences, whether in Asia or in Europe, have been times when they've thought most deeply about their place in the cosmos and been most deeply convinced that they have one. This doesn't have to be religion traditionally defined. Confucianism works very well for this. But that seems to me to be an exceedingly crucial factor.
But Charles, I mean, look, in the 1400s and 1500s, while the Renaissance was going on, the body count in Europe was massive, and it was all in the name of religion. And you talk about Christianity liberating, but I mean, come on, are we talking about the Christianity that showed the instruments of torture to Galileo and made Galileo recant his observations?
I wish you hadn't chosen that particular example, Michael, because I think that in fact the role of Catholicism and Galileo in recent scholarship has gotten very complicated, and I'm not qualified to comment on. But your broader point is, if you're asking, were all sorts of terrible things done in the name of the Church, that's absolutely right. But that doesn't mean that the Church was not also responsible for reformulating Christianity in a way which was, to use the contemporary word, extraordinarily empowering of the individual and liberated and energized all sorts of creation during the Renaissance and beyond. You don't have to...
Yeah, I know.
Just one more sentence on that, Michael. As soon as you mention the word religion, people tend to go off the deep end and say, well, you must be thinking one thing or another about religion. I'm very ambivalent about religion in all sorts of ways, including my own personal belief.
No, I understand that, Charles. But you know, if you say Christianity, I mean, I think that one of the things that the statistical reduction that you do doesn't take into account of is the actual social impact of Christianity, say, in that period of time where it was much like air. I mean, it's so much a part of everything that you could say it's, you know, a reforming influence and also a counter-reforming influence. And of course, that's why the body count was so high.
Well, I'd say that that actually in the text of the book, that what you don't get is this kind of reductionism. That on the contrary, I'd like to think that the discussions of, well, in fact, specifically, there are no numbers in the discussion of the role of Christianity in this.
Right. We're talking about not the role of Christianity, but we are talking about the liberation of the human mind over the last, 2,300 years. We're talking about it with Charles Murray, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. What do you consider to be the great human accomplishments in that period of time, listeners? I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.
Support for...
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour, Connection listeners, with Charles Murray. We're talking about his new book, Human Accomplishment, which seeks to quantify human accomplishment in the years from 800 BC to 1950. Look at why Europe, in his view, and particularly European men, have predominated in human accomplishment, humanity's great aesthetic and scientific achievements. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to join in the conversation. And I'd like to bring into the conversation now Bonnie Smith, who is a professor of history at Rutgers University, author of a number of books, including Making of the West, Peoples and Cultures. And your next book, Bonnie, I think, is Europe in the 20th Century World, which is due out in 2004.
That's right.
Have you read the proofs? We know it's going to
Not
be out
yet.
In 2004?
No, but it better be.
It better be.
I'm getting too old.
Okay. Well, Bonnie, you've been listening to the conversation. Now, what do you think of the methodology that Charles Murray has been using?
Well, I had so many questions as a historian about the methodology, and it may be just because I am a historian, but I really looked back at the people he was using as his models for his kind of method, and I was kind of astonished by that because some of them are kooks, these people who were so absorbed with math and doing all sorts of things with numbers, and Charles Fourier comes to mind. But it seemed to me it was a little like using Karl Marx as a model of how to do history. And I thought maybe he was losing something by using some of these early 19th century people as his prototypes.
Who would you have broadened out to? I mean, if you would even have done this kind of statistical analysis.
Oh, I myself?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't think I would have used this kind of methodology, but it's not that I'm opposed to it. I was just curious if you could talk about it a little bit, because it seemed you might have lost something by using this sort of thing.
Charles?
Well, Francis Galton was the man who was the progenitor of it, and he's one of the great polymaths of history. So kook is not the word I'd use, Bonnie, for Francis Galton. But the larger point is that the method has been used a lot in the technical journals. And, of course, the question is, what do you use it for? And if you use the numbers correctly, you can get important kinds of information that you can't get any other way. For example, you can identify the populations of people who have to be part of the story when you talk about one of these domains, whether it's physics or whether it's Chinese literature or the rest of it. That's a useful thing to do. It's a useful thing to see the kinds of relative attention that's given to different people because, in fact, and I guess, Bonnie, this is where – here's my point. There are lots of issues when you talk about human accomplishment that do, in fact, involve magnitudes. And you can either talk about those magnitudes in an informal qualitative way, or you can be quite explicit about where the magnitudes have come from. I'm reminded of Dick Hernstein, my co-author in The Bell Curve, used to like to say that people say it's easy to lie with statistics. It's a lot easier to lie without them. And I guess the virtue, I think, of a book like mine is that it lays bare so the reader can follow it from beginning to end. This is where these numbers come. This is the way I'm using them. What do you make of them? Here's what I make of them.
Bonnie?
Well, I had some other questions just about the actual methodology. For example, the sources that you use for your quantitative data seem to be mostly English language, then French, then German and Italian, although you do use Japanese. And I was curious that then at the end you get that English, French, German, and Italian creators get the most space. And maybe you could talk to me a little bit, or talk to all of us a little bit about that.
Oh, sure. In the first place, in terms of the indexes for Japanese and Chinese and Indian and so forth, I think you'll find actually that a lot of those are translations of works done by people in those cultures. The second thing is that if you take a look at, I also have Spanish and I have Danish and I have other sources, but the basic point you're raising is one that I worried a lot about, and that is, to what degree are you getting chauvinism in the sources which distorts who gets how much attention? The answer seems to be as follows. In the visual arts and in music, there is some, so that if you get a British history of art, it's going to spend more time on Constable than a French history of art will. But those are fairly minor, because you can listen to music and written by people in other languages and so forth. It's in literature where you have the real problem, that you get way over representation of people writing in the language of their own language, writing about the literature in that language. So what I did in that case was that I based the index scores and the selection of people exclusively on sources not written in that language. In other words, the selection of Shakespeare and his score is based exclusively on sources not written in English. For Racine, there are exclusively sources not written in French and so forth. I also, Bonnie, tested. I mean, there are lots of ways to test the sensitivity of your results to the sources and this kind of prejudice that might be going on, and I did a lot of that. And I think I'm prepared to defend with a lot of confidence that that's no longer a problem in my indexes.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Michael is on the line from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi, this is Michael. I actually teach a class to a Hebrew school in Brookline called about the Golden Age of Spain, basically a period when part of Western Europe was actually ruled by Easterners, by people, Muslim people. And I have to basically say that I think that as far as the West goes, a lot of our progress is due to people from the East, particularly the example of St. Thomas Aquinas. He took his ideas from Muslim scholars, particularly a guy named Averroes, known as Ibn Rushd, I think is pronounced in his native tongue, who was a scholar, a contemporary of Maimonides, who believed, started the idea of mixing faith with reason, that the two don't conflict, and is one of the founders of modern philosophy. It's just other ideas like monotheism and things like that. They all come from the East. These are Eastern ideas. And it's not a coincidence that we start our progress after the 1400s, because that's when the Christians are able to take over Muslim Spain and basically steal a lot of those good ideas. And so I think we're standing on the shoulders of Eastern giants.
I agree.
All right, Michael.
No, I have virtually no argument with anything that the caller just said. The role of the Islamic world in both exposing all of the treasures from Greece and Rome that survived, plus adding to those during its own golden age, it was an extraordinary contribution. And I guess that I want to make sure that listeners don't think that this is a brief. The book is a brief for saying the West did everything important. It's on the contrary. It's trying to figure out why it is, for example, that such things as the Islamic Golden Age arose when it did. Why is it that Sung China was such a golden age of Chinese literature and art? What goes into creating these wonderful eruptions of human excellence?
Concentrations of wealth, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. That helps. You know, you can look at a variety of the usual suspects. So wealth helps. What I call elite cities help. That means cities that are either financial or trade or educational centers. Mm-hmm. Models help a lot. So if you're asking purely from a statistical standpoint, what is the most consistent and powerful predictor of whether you have great figures in Generation X, it is the great figures you had in Generation X minus one. And this has been commented on by historians going back 2,000 years, that people model themselves on those in front of them. But, of course, then the question becomes, all right, wealth helps and cities help and models help. But what gets the process started in the first place? It's kind of like what happened before the Big Bang.
Well, Charles, what gets the process started? I mean, it seems to me that if you have a certain amount of – it doesn't matter if it's a time of peace, because the Renaissance took place against the fact
– we didn't have any peace, yeah.
But it does have a great deal to do, not to put too Marxist a point on it, on a concentration of wealth, usually in a small circle of people's hands, and then it gets dispersed almost because the rulers seem to have an interest. I mean, if we're looking at your select groups of excellent people in the West.
But then you run into problems like Rome. So you had Rome, which had the wealth. You had Rome, which had a lot of these other conditions. And you take a look at the contributions of the Roman Empire at its height to the arts and to sciences, and they're pathetic compared to the Greeks. Yes, they had Ovid and they had Virgil and they had Horace. I'm not saying they had nothing at all. I'm saying that relative to the contribution of the Greeks, they were, as Gibbon said, a nation of pygmies. And so why is it that they didn't do so well? That wealth is an enabling condition, if you want to think of it that way, but it's not causal.
Bonnie, what do you think is the source?
Well, I'd like it if Charles could keep on the point of the cultural borrowing, because one of the things that really struck me in his list is not only Thomas Aquinas's borrowing, but the borrowing that goes all the way down in Europe from the rest of the world, and not just from the Islamic world. But if we look at people like Voltaire or Debussy or Stravinsky or just a whole series of our great cultural figures in the West, they're borrowing, and they're greedy to get the other cultural ideas, right, forms, things like that.
And it was one of the West's greatest strengths.
So the fact is there a Western culture? is it just cultural hybridity? Is it Asia? Is it Islam? Is it Africa that's all being pulled into the work of, say, Picasso or some of the other great figures that you've talked about?
Bonnie, it seems to me there are a couple of points to make about that. One is that one of the distinctive characteristics of the West, as, let's say, compared to China, is that the West was much more fascinated by these other resources out there than China was. China was the Middle Kingdom. It was, and everybody else was barbarians, very reluctant to take advantage of when they had contact with the West of what the West had to offer until it collapsed. The West was vital in large part because it was so willing to reach out. The other point, though, and this is where I think that we have to start to use magnitudes, what you say is quite correct about the borrowing by the West. And then you can say, well, how much of this does this account for? So as we look at the inventory of science, let's talk about scientific events, which is somewhat easier than arts. To which ones of those were in fact borrowed from other cultures? And the answer is some very important ones were, big influence, in terms of the total amount of work done, fairly small. Yeah. And you can be reasonably precise to the reader saying, this is how you come to that conclusion, and you are not... Okay. One of the things that I think is the problem with current multiculturalism is it needs to be more comfortable about talking about these differences in magnitudes. You can talk about the magnificence of another culture's accomplishments.
You keep talking about magnitudes, but I mean, surely it's the singularity of a great artist that is what we're talking about, not the magnitudes of people concentrated in a certain place.
Okay.
I mean, Shakespeare is a singular figure, and that's precisely why in cultures around the world that, you know, where people don't speak English and read him in translation, they feel a sense of ownership. It is the singularities and not the magnitudes that really make for, I mean, since we're talking about your topic that you spent so many years working on, human accomplishment.
Michael, let me rephrase that. Sometimes it's the singularity you're talking about. Sometimes it's the magnitude you're talking about. Just to illustrate, if you want to understand why it is that cultures have produced at certain times wonderful confluences of accomplishment, the singularity isn't going to help you. Because if you have a single great artist who happens to appear in Ecuador or wherever, that does not diminish the singularity, nor does it diminish the excellence of that great artist to say that's the only one we've got in Ecuador.
You're listening
but
to
it
the...
But it does prevent you, Michael, from addressing the kind of question that I wanted to address, which is why Florence, why Athens? So we can both stand in admiration at the singular phenomenon of artistic greatness. We both are in agreement about what's wonderful about art is that singularity. But if we want to have explanatory power dealing with interesting questions, then you've got to pretty much go the route I went.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Rich is on the line from Columbia, South Carolina.
Yes, I have a question for you. When you talk about great accomplishments around the world, why is it that the continent of Africa seems to always be left out? When you talk about the great accomplishments such as the Egyptians made as far as science, religion, we talk about the Africans who went from Northeast Africa to Spain and brought mathematics and science. Why is it that the continent of Africa is always left out as if Greek and the rest of Europe evolved on its own without the help of Africa?
Charles?
In my case, the answer is real simple. I start in 800 BC. And, I mean, I have a chapter where I talk about things that happened before that, but with the huge Egyptian contributions, those aren't in my time frame.
But Rich was also referring to the Moorish presence in Spain in the start of the second millennium.
Oh, but and, if you're talking
about... You know, and that isn't... We think of that as Islamic, but in fact... is African as well?
Well, I think you would have a hard time making the case that it was not essentially the Islamic civilization which was the bearer of a lot of this. Now, did it pick up things that happened? Yes, but if you, again, go and get more specific about who, what, when, where, and why, and so forth, it's much harder to say there was a distinctive African element in this as opposed to the Islamic.
Bonnie?
I'd like to jump in on a point that just slipped by, and that is that both of you raised, and that's about singularity. And Charles, as I said before, I just loved reading this about all the great figures in the book. And at many points in the book, you say that this human accomplishment by any one individual is just simply incomprehensible. They are geniuses. We can never do such things. We have to recognize, and you say, how far these accomplishments are beyond our own power. And, you know, this is a real problem for me as an educator, because I really feel that also as an American, we're supposed to be building capacity and aspirations among our students and among our fellow citizens. And there's a sense here of closing down our aspirations because we're supposed to recognize, in your very words, how far these people are beyond us. And I just wonder what the educational implications are of your book.
Well, Bonnie, I must have made a mistake then, because when I talk about how can a human being have done that and that so far beyond us, I'm talking about the giants. And it is true, I find the giants, and by that I mean the Shakespeares and Michelangelos and the Rembrandts and very small number of people. I think that it's time to say once again, gee whiz, was that spectacular?
Has anyone ever stopped saying that, Charles?
Yeah, I think they have.
Really?
And yes. I think it's happened a lot in education. Well, just let me finish my thought, Michael, on this, which is that I think one of the main things, Bonnie, we need to do in education is indeed say to our students, here is what greatness means. Here's
Bonnie,
a template.
We're coming to the end of the segment, Charles, and we'll pick up this point afterwards. But Bonnie, let me ask you, when you speak to your students, do you ever stop showing your own sense of awe and wonder?
Absolutely never. And that's why I felt there's a defensive tone here. There's something closing down here, this repetition that white male Europeans have done the best over and over and over again. And somehow it's just I'm worried about that. I'm worried about the incomprehensibility of some of these things.
Well, we're coming to the end of the segment. Connection listeners, I apologize. We've been spending a lot of time on methodology and grand theorizing. Maybe we'll talk about the lists in Charles Murray's book after the break. We're talking about human accomplishment, human achievement. Who are the best? Who are the greatest? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour with Charles Murray, whose new book, Human Accomplishment, The Pursuit of Excellence in the Arts and Sciences, tries to take a statistical look at the great achievements of humankind in arts and science, and tries to understand why, in his view, the statistics point to a magnitude of concentration of these achievements in a core group of what are now Western European countries. Although, you know, I don't know that Dante would have seen himself as an Italian, probably more as a Florentine, an exiled Florentine at that. Am I right, Charles?
Right. Yes, indeed.
And we're also talking with Bonnie Smith, who is a professor at Rutgers University. Just before the break, Charles, we were talking about your conclusion that there's an intellectual nihilism at work, and that the universities are full of people who don't love literature, music, and so on. And I was just—it just sounded like a terribly '80s kind of comment. And that it seems to me that if this were the case, then we wouldn't be having as many productions of Shakespeare as we have, and the museums wouldn't be filled to overflowing with people willing to queue for hours to look at old masters and to really be thrilled again. It never really leaves society.
I think things have gotten a lot better than the 80s. I think your point's well taken there. I think on a broader scale, in a way, we are coming out of an adolescence that the human species has had for a couple of hundred years, where we had a variety of ways in which we got a lot of new knowledge very quickly, whether it was Darwin or Freud or Einstein. And like adolescents, we decided our parents were really dumb, and we're growing out of that. I think things are looking up for precisely the kinds of indicators that you suggested. Of course, that leaves open the question, Michael, which I don't deal with in the book in any systematic way. What have we been doing for the last 50 years or so? I mean, what works have we produced anywhere in the last 50 years that people will still care about 200 years from
now. Well, that's a really it's an interesting question. Bonnie, do you want to jump in on that?
Yes, I'd like to jump in on that because one of the things that came to mind reading this book, which is so stimulating, is are lists really the most mature ways to approach the burning cultural questions of our day? And that I'd love to hear whatever anyone has to say.
Well, I mean, the lists are always fun. Just to,
that's my attitude.
Just to promo tomorrow's program, Connection listeners, we're going to be having Nick Hornby, the British author, who's going to be talking about his list of pop songs, the 31 he cannot live without. But I mean, the lists are also arbitrary, and it's in the argument that we have the real debate here. I mean, Charles, for example, you very specifically in your research leave Jane Austen out of the great writers of fiction.
And it broke my heart.
It broke your heart? But I mean,
yes.
Did it really?
Because I wanted her to come out higher.
Yeah.
But you call her a fad. You call her a fashion in your book, not
there was a fad for Jane Austen in the 80s, and there were some wonderful productions. I love Jane Austen. I can quote you large sections virtually verbatim from many of her works. And there are other times in which I looked at these rankings. And I was unhappy with where people ranked. However, that's one of the reasons that when I introduce these lists, which is fairly early in the book, I think it's chapter 7 or 8, and I say, look, these are going to be fun. They're going to stimulate some interesting discussion, I hope. But their purpose is not to say that Jane Austen is 28th and somebody else is 19th, and so therefore we should get very exercised about that difference. They very broadly order people, and that's what they're useful for. So I have to live with Jane's somewhat lower than I would wish ranking.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Bill is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi, I'd like to give your guest a chance to, I haven't read his book, to give him a chance to talk about the Islamic world and also about Asia and the great geniuses there. The Persian poets, for instance, Hafez, Rumi, Ferdowsi, Saadi, these are people who are known absolutely throughout the Asian world. You go into any village in Afghanistan and people can quote you these poets. Mm-hmm. The great theatrical writers Chikamatsu and Nezami in Japan are, again, great geniuses. Tagore in India, the mathematician Ramanujan from India. These are all people who are very well known in those regions by millions of people, and I don't know how they would fit into his statistical assessment. But they're certainly the great treasures of world culture, no question about it.
Yeah, Bill, I want to ask Charles to come in on that because he does have some of these names in lists.
Oh yeah. I mean, there is, for example, understand that for the arts, I do not combine literature from Japan, China, and the West. I have separate ones, and the names that you gave for the great writers, Persian poets, and so forth—they're there. Similarly, the Japanese names you were mentioning are right up at the top of those lists. And furthermore, and I think I'm probably quoting pretty much verbatim from the book. You know, there are such things. When I just said earlier that Du Fu is perhaps the greatest poet who ever lived anywhere, and similarly, a ceremonial tea bowl. Or a rock garden in Japan reflects an aesthetic sensibility that is as subtle and sophisticated as the world has ever known. And, you know, you ought to be able to hold in your mind a couple of things at the same time. And one of them is that this magnificent work has been produced around the world. And another one is Europe was really weird in the degree to which it produced an explosion of work in all sorts of vast quantities of work over a fairly narrow period of time. I think these are interesting questions. They aren't ones in which you are obliged to take on either the role of a Eurocentric, or you are obliged to take on the role of saying the Aztecs and the Japanese and Western Europe were all equal. Those are not required choices.
But I think there are other periods of explosive creativity in history that were equally as narrow. For instance, the Samanid Empire in Central Asia, which produced these great poets, Rudaki, Ferdowsi, and so forth. Which is a period of almost just 100 years. And then there was the Abbasid Empire from the 8th to the 12th century in the Middle East, centered in Baghdad, which produced the great scientific discoveries of the Arab world. These are, this is also an equally narrow period and equally explosive period.
They're certainly equally explosive in the sense of the intensity of the activity within that place. They are not equally in terms of the magnitude of work that was done. And let's talk again about science. You can talk very explicitly about Islamic science, the work in Baghdad, the work in Spain, and the rest of it. You can list here are the various things that were done that were important scientific contributions, and they are part of your inventory. And it is also useful to note that when you've counted all those up and you've also looked at other ways in which they were qualitatively important, it's dwarfed by other explosions.
But what is the purpose of...
Bonnie, you're asking the question that's going through my brain. You go, you're a guest. I'm just the host.
What is the purpose of just hammering this message, which is in chapter after chapter, that for this 500-year period, there's a great deal of... creativity in the West. It goes over. Somehow I feel that you feel embattled on this. And I'm just curious, do you feel that there's a battle going on against these authors creators?
Well, let me recharacterize the book, which you just said hammers in this chapter after chapter. What I would say, Bonnie, is that chapter 11 says, folks, for the next 7 or 8 chapters, most of the analysis is going to deal with Western Europe from 1400 to 1950. In this chapter, I want to tell you why. And the reason why is because that's where most of the material is. So the subsequent chapters do indeed analyze the material from the West because that's where the data are. And that's an important point to make when we look at some of these other centers of culture. You can say, you know, there was this fascinating upsurge of activity in poets in this one place in this one century, but you can't really analyze that because, in effect, your data points are too few. Now, if you say, well, but you could analyze it qualitatively, absolutely. And books are written analyzing it qualitatively. It's also useful, and it adds to your toolbox if you look at these things quantitatively. And if you do that, the gold mine for you is Europe from 1400 to 1950. So that's where, as Willie Sutton said, that's where the money is. That's why you rob the bank.
You're listening.
Where you focus on Western Europe.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Charles is calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Charles? Okay. We've lost Charles there. Let's go back to, I mean, I've got 5 minutes left in the program, and I've got two directions I want to go. One is to point out, Charles, that you have avoided talking about architecture and design in terms of aesthetic achievement because I think a lot of people would argue that in architecture and design, non-European cultures really are quite extraordinary.
Oh, come on. Yeah. I left out architecture because of the technical issues, whereby you had different sources which were very good in the visual arts, which would sometime include architecture quite comprehensively and sometimes not. But I do have – that's a very good example, Michael, because actually there's a specific quote in the book with regard to this. Shall we take great architecture, and then do we have examples from Southeast Asia as well as places like China and India, the rest of it? Do we have things from South America that belong in that? Absolutely. We certainly do. And then if you go to Europe and then take comparable sample of great architecture, these fine examples from the rest of the world are just overwhelmed in number. I mean, if you just forget about all the secular buildings, but
Charles, there, you know, I mean, that is an extraordinarily subjective statement.
No, it's not. No, I will say that as a...
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm really sure because...
And in terms of design...
Anytime...
In terms of design, Charles, I mean, if you look at abstraction, why is it that an abstraction on the ceiling of a mosque of the most intricate design...
Absolutely.
...done by a workshop of people rather than a single designer... Why, again, would you feel compelled, I suppose,
Michael,
to sort of say, yes, well, it's all wonderful, except on an order of magnitude, it's just not as great as Shark.
Michael, here's the problem. If you say, let's take in design done by teams, as you just said, from mosques, that's great. Let's bring that into the mix. And if we've brought that into the mix, let's also bring in all of the comparable anonymous teamwork kinds of things that were done in European cathedrals and European, you know, shall we take, for example, should we consider art? to consist of everyday objects, such as warriors' shields in Africa or baskets or fabrics. That's fine. But then you go to Europe, and they have traditions of those kinds of everyday objects made in beautiful ways with different traditions for each country and varying over time up to Barcelona chairs and starting with armor. So, Michael, my point is any time you try to broaden the definition, if you're trying to diminish the contribution of Europe, it doesn't work, because if you apply the same rule to Europe,
you're going to have an avalanche of stuff. I'm not sure that anybody's trying to diminish. One's trying to just open up. Go ahead. Bye.
But there are people on your list who are working in teams, and we think of William Herschel as a good example.
Sure.
Titian, some of the artists, and they kind of sneak in there as a singular human beings as opposed to being part of a team. And
Bonnie, real quickly, since we are running out of time. I have inventories of events in the sciences, so you can tabulate the event, which may have been done by any number of people, to see if the story the events tell is the same as the story that the individuals tell. And in that case, the stories are the same.
Charles, we're coming to the end of the show. You posed the question earlier about what has been achieved in the last 50 years. I take it that you're deeply skeptical.
Well, I have a few nominations that I think are really wonderful things that I hope people care about, but I don't think there are very many.
Give us an example.
Well, my favorite, which I'm already on record for, is I think Groundhog Day is a brilliant moral fable that deserves to survive forever. But I don't have a whole lot of others. And I guess that my challenge is to other people, can you think of any? And I keep going back to the analogy of Rome, and I wonder if we aren't maybe a nation of pygmies in the same way the Romans were in the arts.
Well, Harold Macmillan often said that Britain was Greece to America's Rome. Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister of Britain, and it's a view the English often express to me, and I live in London. But I sometimes think they're just jealous that I'm an American. I'm never quite sure. Lists are fun. I'm not quite sure about statistical redaction of artistic excellence. I prefer to think of it simply as something that can never really be fully explained. Charles Murray, thank you very, very much for joining us. Charles Murray is the author of Human Accomplishment. He was speaking to us from the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, Charles. And Bonnie Smith, who is a professor of history at Rutgers University. We'll look for your book next year, Bonnie, Europe in the 20th Century World. Thank you for joining us. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.